Well, today we are going to conclude our little short series on the pilgrims. We've seen them in England, their time of persecution, and they chose to flee for religious reasons to Holland. They were in Holland for 11 to 12 years. The Lord grew the people. He informed and instructed them through just life in the lowlands there in Holland. And then they went across to the New World. We're not really going to spend much time on the voyage itself. There are some interesting things on the voyage where we can see God's hand at work. But we want to move them across and get on to the New World. And we're only going to land them and look at the first couple of years. It's a mini-series, not an in-depth series. So we'll just kind of go with that. The pilgrims were separatists. They did not want to wait for the Church of England to reform, so we can call them impatient Puritans. They were congregational in their church government, so they believed that they, the people, would elect their leaders and would have a significant voice in the say of how the church ran. And that is why they had to separate from the Church of England, because the monarch was the one who made those decisions. When they were in Leiden, Holland, the pilgrims were noted for their honesty and hard work. If the people of Holland needed to find a good, hard worker, they would look to the people of the church first because of the reputation that they had. And God blessed them. Many from England would flee and come to Holland to participate with them, and so their number grew. But after 11 to 12 years, they realized that it was time to leave. The circumstance in Holland was hard. They were farmers. They weren't used to the trades that were there in Holland. It was a different language. It was difficult for others to join them because life was difficult in Holland. Some people preferred imprisonment in England over the difficulty of life in Holland. It's kind of mind-boggling, but it's a reality of how hard both circumstances were. Many of the people were growing old, and they felt that they were growing old faster because of the difficulty of the work. So they were laborers. I mean, farmers aren't lazy people. I mean, they get out there and they're working hard too. But this was, I guess, a different order from what the farmers were accustomed. The children, it was hard labor on the children. They saw many of them becoming, their vitality was broken. There was the Dutch youth. They were extravagant, and they saw some of their kids getting caught up with the wildness of the Dutch youth, and they didn't want that either. And lastly, and it's only lastly in order, not in importance, they wanted to promote the gospel. They heard about this new world, and they saw a gospel opportunity. They did not see the hand of the monarch there controlling them and how they could share the gospel, and so that was of interest to them. On the voyage itself, only 50 from the church were able to make the voyage. They couldn't all make it due to finances and other constraints. And then there were 52 strangers. They weren't members of the church, but the company in London, they put more people on the ship so they could get more produce and product from the New World. So it was kind of a half-half mix there. Some of the people are familiar. William Brewster, he was an elder in the church, and so he sailed on the Mayflower, so he went across. William Bradford is a little bit older. He was staying with the Brewster family there in Holland. He also went across, but their pastor, John Robinson, remained. Again, only a portion of the people were able to make it, and so Brewster, as a leader in the church, went, and Robinson, as the pastor, remained behind to shepherd the flock there. And then we find a new man, Captain Miles Standish. He was hired by the London Company as a soldier, and so he went across, and his intent was to plant his roots there in the New World as well. Some of the passengers on the ship, and this would refer more to the strangers, they were aware that the charter for New England had not been completed before they set sail. And they suggested that without a patent in place, they would be free to do as they chose upon landing and ignore the contract with the investors. They had hired themselves out all of them as indentured servants, and this looked like an opportunity to look out for themselves. The leaders of the Pilgrim recognized that such attitudes would be detrimental that first winter. They more than likely also had the words of their pastor's letter ringing in their ears. He was encouraging them to work together and to stand together. It was critical that life was ordered and orderly, not just because it was the new world, but because they were Christians and they saw the instructions of Scripture to be ordered and orderly. To remedy the problem, they wrote the Mayflower Contract. It was signed by all of the men on board. It reads, "In the name of God, amen. We whose names are underwritten, the loyal subjects of our dread sovereign Lord, King James, by the grace of God, of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, King, Defender of the Faith." Just as a side note, why is King James called the Defender of the Faith? Excuse me?
He's the head of the church.
Exactly. He's the head of the church. And so that's ringing that the monarch is in charge. And so in the preface to the compact, they acknowledge that. Having undertaken for the glory of God an advancement of the Christian faith in honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, do by these presents solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid, and by virtue hereof to enact laws, ordinances, acts, constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience, in witness whereof we have hereunder subscribed our names." And it concludes with the rest of that. Why is the compact so important? And we're only just going to scratch the surface of the content of that. But it is the beginning of self-government in the affairs of men and nations, not just in the New World, but of all nations. It's the beginning of a democratic institution that would bud in the colony and flower in our country's constitution several hundred years hence. The Pilgrims were not radicals or revolutionaries. They were reasoned Christians who sought to serve God. As such, we cannot consider the compact as a revolutionary departure from English precedent, but a pragmatic application of it. In 1889, William Breckinridge stated that the document was not a constitution, nor yet a charter, nor yet in a true sense a social compact, but rather the complete demonstration that they were planting the seeds of the old truths, not attempting to make some new and unknown harvest from untried seed. There are many today that cannot see the hand of providence anywhere, even when they trip over it. They will raise their voices against God's working in such things as the Mayflower Compact. Both the compact and the United States Constitution, coupled with the Declaration of Independence, have important principles in common. The belief that government is a form of covenant and that for government to be legitimate, it must derive from the consent of the governed. As we continue to look at excerpts from their journey, I want us to remember that they were one church, one body of believers. Because they were not some large group comprised of many different subgroups, we are better able to see and understand how God worked in their midst. God did add the 52 strangers to them as part of the voyage, and this did complicate their situation and make them cling to God. But it also strengthened their testimony to the strangers and beyond. The Pilgrims did not seek glory or great things. They were not trying to establish a name for themselves. Rather, they desired to worship God according to their conscience and to live faithfully for Him in their lives. Just as Solomon did not ask for riches, but God gave them, in like manner, the Pilgrims and their faithfulness were blessed by God with a name for themselves. We're talking about them today. We have already seen that in Holland, where the merchants preferred to hire members of the church, again, because of their honesty and hard work. The Mayflower arrived in the New World in late November. It left England in September, and it was a two-month voyage across. However, they did not disembark at Plymouth for another 30 days. Time was taken up in repairing their shallop, their small sailing vessel, and exploring the area for an appropriate settlement site. On December 16th, they landed. They began immediately to construct a common house where supplies would be stored. Work was done cooperatively on this house, where it was agreed that each man would build his own house himself. The common house was completed in mid-January. I'm just checking my slides. Sorry. Oh, I got ahead of myself. Joe nicely put the laptop there, so all I have to do is lift my eyes, but I have to lift my eyes to read the slide. So just to give us perspective, the Pilgrims landed in 1620. 10 years prior, Jamestown was settled further south in Virginia. In 1617, there was a smallpox plague of the Patuxet Indians that was in the area of Plymouth. And we'll come to that shortly, but that's an important time or an important event that leads up to the Pilgrims. And we've called the Pilgrims impatient Puritans. But it's interesting, just 5 years later, the Puritans from England sailed over to Salem. So the separatists were 5 years ahead. Although I would posit that their 11 to 12 years in Holland prepared them better for life in the New World than the Puritans, who simply, it's like somebody just leaving home and getting married. They don't have any experience on their own. Whereas the Pilgrims had experience in Holland and they were more adept. And we'll touch on that as well. So I'm behind on the slides. Sorry about that. So the Pilgrims landed, and there's a photo that they took at that time. Okay. I always like putting that picture up because you gave me the result that I was expecting. It happened last time, and it's fun to do that. So they were building a common house, but construction was difficult by the weather that they had at that time of year. Again, I grew up in Arizona, moved here to California, so November and December is kind of like what we're experiencing now, you know, upper 70s, low 80s. But January back then in the Northeast, as I am told, is frigid and biting. And I will take people at their word for that, as I think of the northern part of our country. I'm glad I live where I do. Soon after their arrival, illness struck the Pilgrims and the crew of the ship. The first death occurred on January 29th. It was Rose Standish, the wife of their military captain, Miles Standish. Within 2 months' time, half of the passengers and half of the crew would be dead. Bradford writes, "But that which was most sad and lamentable was that in 2 or 3 months' time, half their company died, especially in January and February, being the depth of winter and lacking houses and other comforts, being infected with scurvy and other diseases which this long voyage and the unhealthy condition had brought upon them, so as there died sometimes 2 or 3 in a day during that period of time, and that of 100 and some odd persons, scarcely 50 remained. And of these, in the time of most distress, there is but 6 or 7 healthy persons, who to their great praise, it should be said, spared no pains, night or day, but with much effort and risk to their own health, fetched them wood, made them fires, prepared them meat, made their beds, washed their disgusting clothes, dressed and undressed them, all this willingly and cheerfully, without any grumbling in the least, showing herein their true love unto their friends and brethren. A rare example and worthy to be remembered, 2 of these 7 were Mr. William Brewster, the Reverend Elder, and Miles Standish, their captain and military commander, unto whom myself and many others were much indebted in our low and sick condition. And yet the Lord so upheld these persons as in this general calamity that they were not at all infected either with sickness or lameness. During early spring, their governor, John Carver, died. William Bradford was elected governor. He was 31 years old. Cotton Mather would later write about Bradford. If he had not been a person of more than ordinary piety, wisdom, and courage, he would have sunk under the difficulties of governing the settlement. In fact, Bradford would prove to be an exemplary leader and was elected no fewer than 30 times. They had annual elections for the position of governor. In the fall of 1621, their first fall in the New World, Bradford wrote, "They began now to gather in the small harvest they had and to prepare their houses and dwellings for winter, being all well recovered in health and strength and had all things in good plenty. For as some were thus employed in affairs abroad, others were employed at fishing of cod and bass and other fish of which they had brought in a good supply, and of which every family had their portion. All summer there was no need, and now begin to come in supply of fowl, as winter approached, of which this place did abound when they came first, but afterwards decreased by degrees over the years. And besides waterfowl, there was a great store of wild turkeys, of which they took many, besides venison. Besides, they had about a peck of meal a week per person, and now since harvest, Indian corn in the same amount. Despite their numbers being cut in half by sickness and death, they found reasons for thankfulness. They had gained their foothold on the edge of an inhospitable continent. They were well recovered in health and strength. They were making the best of a hard life in the wilderness. They had proved that they could sustain themselves in the new free land, and they were assured of the success of their purpose of establishing freedom. They had made firm friends with the Indians who had been kind to them. The date of the first Thanksgiving is unknown. However, in a letter dated December 21st, Edward Winslow, one of their numbers, relates the following. "Last spring, we planted some 20 acres of Indian corn."
Is there a slide?
No, there's no slide. It's too long. "They planted Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas. According to the manner of the Indians, we fertilized our ground with herrings, which we had in great abundance, and take care with ease at our doors. Our corn did well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn. Our barley did acceptably well, but our peas not worth the gathering. We feared they were sown too late. Our harvest had brought in. Our governor sent 4 men out fowling," we would say upland game hunting, "so that we might, after a special manner, rejoice together after we had gathered in the fruits of our labors. The 4 of them killed in 1 day as many fowl as with little help besides, served the company for almost a week. At this time amongst our recreation, we drilled with our firearms, many of the Indians joining us, and amongst the rest, their great king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom we entertained and feasted for 3 days. They went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation, and offered our governor, the captain, and others. Although it was not always so plentiful as it was at this time with us, yet by the goodness of God, we are so far from want that we often wish you partakers of our plenty. We have found the Indians very faithful in their covenant of peace with us, very loving and ready to please us. Some of us have been 50 miles into the country by land with them. There is now great peace amongst us, and we for our parts walk as peaceably and safely in the woods here as in the highways in England. I never in my life remember a more seasonable year than we have enjoyed. If we had cows, horses, and sheep, I make no doubt that men might live as content here as any part of the world." So that was the first Thanksgiving, but it was not to continue that way. So while they enjoyed a bountiful feast, an inventory taken afterwards showed that they had grossly overestimated the harvest. In order to get through the winter, they cut the weekly rations in half. Then in November, the ship Fortune arrived with 35 new settlers sent by the adventurers in England. They arrived empty-handed and poorly clothed, ill-equipped for the approaching winter. When the ship returned to England, After a month, the colony had to supply it with supplies for the return voyage. And at first glance, you go, why? Well, the ship consumed its supplies coming across, and the plantation was the only place to resupply. This pattern often repeated itself on the colony. A need was pressed upon them, a need that they did not expect nor have surplus to supply. Yet they would supply that need as they were able, often to their detriment. By the next spring, their food supply was gone and the harvest still 4 months away. Edward Winslow was sent up the coast to obtain provisions from the English ships fishing in the region. All who were asked gave what they could, and no one would accept payment of any kind. The new provisions were divided, and when rationed out, each person received a quarter pound of bread a day. The charter or patent of Plymouth Colony required them to regularly send commodities back to England for trade and commerce. All of the passengers on the Mayflower were bound to this obligation, and half of them died within 3 months of arriving, placing the same burden on fewer people. For all of their needs, they labored together and shared together in the results. The planting, harvesting, fishing were all done as a community. In turn, what was gained was divided equally amongst themselves. Civics question. What term would you use to describe this situation or setup? Let me read that again. For all their needs, they labored together and shared together in the results. The planting, harvesting, fishing were all done as a community, and in turn, what was gained was divided equally amongst themselves. What would you call this?
Socialism.
Very good. Socialism. I also heard communism. Socialism and communism are evil stepchildren of one another. What would be a contrasting or opposite approach?
Capitalism.
Okay. In our country today, we see and hear the free market capitalism being disparaged regularly and socialism being foisted upon us. We are told that the market is not adequate for settling affairs between men. We need the security of a command and control structure to provide equally for all men. Many years before Adam Smith wrote his Wealth of Nations in 1776, William Bradford wrote in 1623 and addressed the subject directly and did not mince words. This is a little lengthy. There's a few elements on the slide, but I'll be reading all of it. And again, what's important, this is being written in 1623. So they've had 2 years under the socialistic or the communal situation. And so now Bradford is writing about that, giving an analysis and a summary for us. All this while no supply was heard of, and they neither knew where they might expect any. So they begin now to think how they might raise as much corn as they could and obtain a better crop than they had done, that they might not still thus languish in misery. At length, after much debate of things, the governor, with the advice of the chiefest among them, gave way that they should set every man corn for himself, and in that regard trust to themselves, and all other things to go on in the general way as before. And so assigned to every family a parcel of land according to the proportion of their number for that end, and arranged all boys and youth under some family. This had very good success, for it made all hands very industrious, so as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been by any means the governor or any other could use, and saved him a great deal of trouble, and gave far better result. The women now went willingly into the field, and took their little ones with them to set corn, which before would allege weakness and inability, whom to have compelled would have been thought great tyranny and oppression. The experience that they had in this common course and condition tried several years, and that amongst godly and sober men may well reveal the vanity of that conceit of Plato and other ancients applauded by some of later times, that the taking away of property and putting in common into a commonwealth would make them happy and flourishing as if they were wiser than God. A quick footnote. Bradford had in his possession a book that derided Plato's Republic. The author in that book writes, "But he, Plato, understood not that by making all things thus common, a commonwealth must needs perish. For nothing can be public where nothing is private, albeit that such a commonwealth should also be against the law of God and nature, which expressly forbids us to desire anything that is another man's." Bradford continues, "For this common community, so far as it was found to breed much confusion and discontent and retard much employment which would have been to their benefit and comfort. For the young men that were most able and fit for labor and service did complain that they should spend their time and strength to work other men's wives and children without any recompense. The strong or man of parts had no more division of food and clothes than he that was weak and not able to do a quarter the other could. This was thought injustice. The aged and graver men to be ranked and equalized in labors and food and clothes with the meaner and younger sort thought it some indignity and disrespect unto them. As for men's wives being commanded to do service for other men as dressing their meat, washing their clothes, etc., they deemed it a kind of slavery. Neither could many husbands well tolerate it. Upon the point all being to have alike and all to do alike, they thought themselves in the like condition, and one as good as another. And so if they did not cut of those relations that God has set among them, yet it did at least much diminish and take of the mutual respect that they should be preserved amongst them, and would have been worse if they had been men of another condition." So it's interesting as we look at this, I say communism was tried here, and it failed. But the interesting thing is we're here with a group of Christians that in that communal lifestyle are trying to care for one another, and they're recognizing that it's not working. And so if you take that experiment, if you will, outside of the bounds of godly men, well, history shows us the results of that. There's a lot there. Any questions or comments? I don't want to rush through that. Oh, Michelle, hang on.
Oh. I'm curled up in a ball. I can't hardly stand.
All right. John, up here.
So what we see in the Bible where we had all things in common, the men did, is a type of socialism that works when it's not forced on us, I guess, right? These guys are not, they're trying the socialism as a rule, but it seems to work when it's done willfully, like by Christians.
Well, I think when you look at the early church there in Acts, there was a lot of people of selling of goods and putting into the bounty of the church for distribution by the church leaders. And so it wasn't the same type of situation that we see here going on. This is day-to-day life is communal. You don't get anything unless you put in. Whereas if you... our offerings and tithes to the church are directed by the church leaders. And so it's not, now it comes in, we have 85 members, let's take that surplus and divide it by 85. We aren't seeing that type of thing. It doesn't go out so freely. There's also, and it's been a while since I've looked at it, you could also say that the believers in Jerusalem at that time were a little overzealous and may have gone a little too far towards too much communal living, and hence they were ill-prepared for the subsequent years, and the churches in Asia were needed to provide for their needs. So
you got to be... work.
I don't think it works.
No.
Because it breeds laziness. It's in our nature to be lazy. We don't want to work. And somebody could be industrious, but in a communal situation, they're going to be less industrious. They're going to be more industrious than their neighbor, and so they are thought industrious. But if they now have to provide for their own, I mean, we see men and women, they will rise to the occasion because need drives that. Anything else? All right. We're going to go back to the spring of 1621. So this was just a few months after they had been there. They were trying, they had half of their number die. They're now trying to set their crops out. And so on March 16th, a tall Indian walked boldly into the plantation and cried out, "Welcome, welcome, Englishmen." He said that in English. He said it like that. His name was Samoset. He introduced himself as being an Abnaki Indian from Maine who was kidnapped by explorers and taken to England. The pilgrims welcomed him and asked him many questions. I feel sorry for that guy. He's probably sit here. And then they just pepper him with questions for probably the rest of the day. They learned that the Patuxet Indians, who formerly owned the land where their settlement stood, and 4 years later had died from the smallpox plague. So we're coming back around to that event in 1617. So in an unusual providence, God prepared that area to be made ready for the pilgrims to settle. Several days later, Samoset returned and was accompanied by another Indian named Squanto, who amazed the pilgrims with his almost flawless command of English. Squanto was a Patuxet Indian from that area, but was captured in 1614. He lived in England for several years and learned to speak English, and in 1619 he returned and found his people dead. The Wampanoag Indians lived in the area at that time. Squanto and Samoset were able to gradually reassure them that the pilgrims were peaceful and did not intend to harm them. They told them of the pilgrims' desire to make a treaty of peace with them. And on March 22nd, Samoset and Squanto arranged a meeting with Massasoit, the chief of the Wampanoags, to establish a peace treaty. This treaty was honored by both parties for many years. Although the treaty itself benefited the pilgrims, the Indians gained great respect from neighboring tribes who feared the weaponry of the English. Both Samoset and Squanto spent a great deal of time with the pilgrims. Squanto taught them how to find herring and how to use it as fertilizer when planting corn, pumpkin, and beans. This was important to the pilgrims because the seeds they had brought with them did not do well in the New England soil. He also showed them how to find clams and eels in the river and how to hunt for deer, bear, and turkeys. Ladies, how would you like to be given a bunch of eel and said, "There's dinner"? Yes, hunger might not be a bad thing. So it's on the slide in front of you, but we need to see how God is working through unexpected events. Two English-speaking Indians were in the area where the Mayflower landed. Two Indians that just happened to speak English, just happened to be where the pilgrims and the Mayflower landed. Quite an amazing thing when you think about it. Squanto spent a great deal of time helping and assisting the pilgrims, even though he had been captured and mistreated several times by other Englishmen. I think an important note is when we live a godly life and the character of Christ is shining through us, other people will see it. And the Dutch saw that, and I would suggest that Squanto and Samoset saw that, and the Wampanoag Indians saw that. A peace treaty was made that both sides honored for many, many years. And again, we mentioned the entire Patuxet tribe was displaced by disease, but Squanto, a Patuxet, came back and showed the pilgrims how to survive in the very place where he grew up, knowing all the local conditions immediately. Who better to be your guide than one who grew up there? So we've touched briefly on the story of the pilgrims, and it is a story full of the workings of a gracious God in the midst of one of his churches, a candlestick set on a hill for the world to see. Many people took advantage of the colony to their personal benefit and the hurt of the colony. Yet the pilgrims strove to exercise Christian charity throughout. In our three lessons, we have only touched on highlights of their story. I pray that it was done in a way that would inspire and encourage you in your Christian walk, both personally and within our local church, and also to consider further study towards that end. Original source material is by William Bradford of Plymouth Plantation, so most of the quotes that I've done have been from there. It is in Old English, and I would strongly encourage you, if you are not a fan of Old English, to find an unabridged modern English version. It still will be a challenge, but it's much more accessible in modern English. And then the other eyewitness account, it's attributed to Edward Winslow, is called Mort's Relation. It's a much shorter book. Again, I would look at the modern English version for that. Other books to expand, Charles Coffin around 1870, 1875, wrote Sweet Land of Liberty and The Story of Liberty. The volume Sweet Land of Liberty spends the most time with the pilgrims. And so that would give you a more thorough understanding of their particular story. He writes his history as a story. You start on page one, and the story just doesn't stop. As I recall, there are no chapter breaks. There are no of these paragraph markings that we have in our books today. The story begins and doesn't stop until it gets to the end. So it's kind of an interesting approach. And then there are four internet resources. And I checked again as I was doing this series on Wikipedia. If you search Pilgrim's Plymouth Colony today, you'll get decent results. Don't know what the future will have since it's Wikipedia, but it does provide a good overview. And then you have some other sites that are down there. One of them, I believe Mayflower History is a historical organization. And then the other two, I believe, are churches that are putting up material. They're more East Coast oriented. They're closer to the pilgrims. They want to support and encourage that. So those would be for further study. Any questions or anything? Brendan.
I just want to make a comment. Going back to earlier about your addressing socialism, communism, I think as Christians we come to realize we're in a fallen world, and when you think of forms of governments, economies, and so forth, there is nothing perfect because, again, we're in a fallen world. The choices between what's better than the other choice and what would allow for more freedom, and which one is supported more so by God's moral precepts and a Christian worldview, which would give us a better understanding of freedom, because you have to have boundaries. You can't have anarchy. I don't know, does that make sense?
Yes.
So I'm trying.
Any other comments? I see that has it in hand.
I think your challenge is that you have people that desire freedom and liberty, but then there's also a desire for security and
safety.
Being safe and being provided for. So when you've not had one, like in this case, they didn't have liberty, that was something they desired to have and to retain. And now we have people that are willing to give up their freedom and their liberty in order to feel secure and safe and taken care of. So, and they're both things that people that are valid, things to want for, in your life. So I think that's why the various forms of government, there's a struggle there. And people now seem to care more about feeling secure than enjoying liberty, which, yeah, I don't know.
You sound like a Baptist. Liberty and security, those are the two of our key issues. And Ken, I don't remember which lesson you were teaching a while ago, but I raised my hand. I don't know if you remember my comment, but I said security is a perception. And I really believe that to be true. We think we are secure, and it's only in our mind. We are not truly secure in the world in which we live. Doesn't matter what you do to protect your house, someone can get in if they're determined. All we're doing is trying to deter the wannabe crooks. If somebody wants to do you harm, it will be done. And as we live our lives, there are no guarantees. And the question is, why? And I would suggest it comes back to the heart of man. If we as Calvinists understand the heart of man is sinful, now as we look at different options in front of us, it will inform us in our decisions. Nothing, as Brendan said, is secure or perfectly flawless in its workings. I'll take the word secure back. But it doesn't work perfectly because of men. So when you think of an economic situation or a civic situation, which is better? Well, if you have a socialistic perspective, where is power? The question is, where does the power reside? The higher up the power resides, the less freedom and liberty that you have. And what is your ability to make changes? And why did the pilgrims leave? Why did the separatists leave England? Because the power was so high and unwielding and unwilling to make changes. The powers that be were making their decisions, I would say, in self-interest. Because if the monarch allowed changes in the church, if they allowed church leaders to have input, they felt that they then lost control of the country. Not just the church, but they would lose their kingly or queenly power. So it was self-interest that drove that. And so if you have more of a congregational form of church government, where the power is with the people, if you have a capitalistic type of society, the power is with the individual, change can be done more readily. It may not be done more quickly. We have to wait. It could be that the leaders of the church have a burr under their saddle, whatever that might mean, and so they are doing things a particular way in the church, and you may not like it. Is it a sin thing, or is it a preference thing? And so now you have to determine, will I submit, or is this something that violates my conscience? As we're in the market, we see a wrong done. Well, the market will correct it if you let it, but it might not be fast enough. Too many people are impatient. Just real quickly, to give us a little bit of a contrast that I think kind of plays in on this, we haven't talked about Jamestown at all, and I'm just going to kind of quickly go over this. Jamestown was started with 105 people. They were all men. They were gentlemen and businessmen, and these gentlemen did not feel like they needed to work. The Plymouth settlement was 102 people, families and poor farmers. So Jamestown came to find riches. Well, the Plymouth Brethren, among other things, came for religious reasons. Why did the story begin? Because of religious persecution. Three ships were sent by King James to Jamestown, and one ship was hired privately for Plymouth. The Jamestown ship took 4 months and arrived in April. And the Mayflower, took 9 weeks, 2 months, and arrived in November. In Jamestown, the king chose who the leaders were. If something happened, they had to send a note across the pond. They had to wait a couple of months. Then the reply would be given, and the message would come back, and they'd see who the new leader was, or the new leader would be on the ship. In Plymouth, they elected their leaders. In Jamestown, they fought with the local Indians. But up in Plymouth, they made friends with them. And I think it is interesting that smallpox plague that basically cleared the land of inhabitants, all inhabitants, for the pilgrims to settle. While the Wampanoag Indians were around and did, there was a little bit of conflict the first couple of months, but it wasn't as though they had were dropped into the backyards of some Indians. The Jamestown, they signed the first charter of Virginia, and up at Plymouth, we see the Mayflower Compact, a different approach to governing people. And Jamestown developed into an aristocratic society. England was transplanted into Jamestown. And in Plymouth, we see the development of a democratic society where power rests with the people. Again, when we look at Plymouth, all of these things are seeds. They're just the first beginnings. And we can see little seedlings in the life of the Plymouth colony. It's not a mature plant. Nothing matures in the colony for over 100 years. That takes time for the things that we enjoy today. But I enjoy the story of the pilgrims because we can see God's hand at work if we choose to see him working. And the Plymouth settlement is primarily a church that was replanted into another location. And so God is in their midst. As we struggle and have difficulties, let us be encouraged. We are not alone. Others have gone a similar path. They've persevered. The Lord encourages and provides. The Lord does not provide according to the dictates of our list. He provides according to our true spiritual needs, and we need to always take encouragement in that. Any final comments? That would be brief. If not, let's close in prayer. Lord, we thank you for this brief time we could look back at the history of the pilgrims and their church. And again, we are thankful to see your hand at work in so many providential ways. We pray that you would help us not to think of this as a mere story, but as an example of how you are providing for the people of your church. And Lord, that gives us confidence as a small church ourselves that you will make provision for us. And as we come to the next hour, the provision we most desire is to be fed by the word as it is preached to us. We pray that you would encourage our hearts to that regard. In Christ's name, amen.